Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Last fall, it was billed as the summit to save the world. Tomorrow's G20 meeting was supposed to rebalance the global economy. They still have to actually have the meeting, but the bar has been reset pretty low. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 1st of April, and it is great to have you with us. This was a bad day to be a British banker. In London today, the Bank of England and the Royal Bank of Scotland took the brunt of the protests at the G20 meeting. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets. They overwhelmed London police. They trashed bank offices, burned bankers in effigy, and carried signs calling today Financial Fool's Day. Never mind that the meeting they're protesting, leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies, doesn't even get started until tomorrow. And it's not at all clear what will come of the get-together anyway. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is at the European desk in London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
In an ideal world, Mr. Beard, what would we know tomorrow that we don't know already about this summit?
Well, this summit has been somewhat optimistically billed as the summit to save the global economy. The aim is to agree a plan of recovery and reform, course of action that will get the world out of recession and then prevent the banks and other financial players from getting us into this kind of mess again. Those are the aims, but of course, it's the ways and means to achieve them that's the big issue, and there have been some big disagreements about that.
Along the lines of regulation versus stimulus, right?
Indeed.
Okay, so let me ask you the stimulus question then, and a lot of it has been about that. We here in the United States prefer more direct stimulus. The Europeans are saying, wait a minute, we don't need to spend more money because we have all these social safety nets. Doesn't that, though, sort of get to the same place eventually, whether it's direct government spending or social safety net spending?
That's the European argument. I mean, if you tot everything up, the US is doing a lot more at the moment to stimulate its economy than the Europeans are. But you're right, the Europeans say, as the recession here deepens, Europe's more generous welfare system will come into play, and that'll mean European governments will be stimulating their economies like crazy. In fact, some economists suggest that by next year, Germany will be pumping in more public money proportionally than the US. Again, you know, the American argument would be, shouldn't you be pumping the money in before people lose their jobs? But that's basically the divide between continental Europe and the U.S.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy had a joint press conference today in which they said, we hope to work things out with the Obama administration, but, you know, you never know. Are people making too much of the European-American split in this whole thing?
I don't think so. I think this is a genuine fault line at this summit with the US and the UK on one side and France and Germany on the other. The French and the Germans are sick to death with having been lectured by the Americans and the Brits over the years about their sluggish, inflexible economies. For the French and the Germans, this summit is payback time. This is the chance for them to say, look where your deregulation and your liberal markets got you. And they've been using the run-up to the summit to push very hard for much tougher controls on bankers' bonuses. And that's where a lot of the tension has been, the argument about how far these countries should go in regulating their finance industries.
You know, Stephen, this is called the G20. And let's see, we've got the Americans, the Brits, the French, and the Germans. If you do a little math, that's 16 other countries at least. There are some others who've invited themselves. What about, though, some of the bigger developing economies, the Russians and the Chinese specifically?
this actually clearly is a big moment for them, and especially for the Chinese, a chance to punch their weight on the world stage. And in fact, the Chinese appear to regard this not so much as a G20 as a G2 summit, since in their view, it's only the US and China that really matter anymore. But this gathering, absolutely, as you say, does show the shift in economic power, the growing importance of countries like China and India. But again, because there are so many delegations involved, it does mean that it's a lot more difficult to agree anything that's meaningful. And the big danger is that the communique which emerges after tomorrow's summit will be rather too vague to have any real impact on the global downturn.
Stephen Beard at the European Desk in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
It's probably not promising that a lack of bad news is taken as good, but that seems to be what Wall Street was looking at today. Housing and cars were the topics of discussion. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The G20 has led the economic news the past couple of days, but really the event itself, that is the meeting between the leaders of all the various countries tomorrow, is only going to last 4 hours. It's not a lot of time to save the global economy, so commentator David Frum thinks it's handy that the Europeans, at least, will be feeling a little bit of deja vu.
Have you seen this movie before? A brash and self-confident American president has a big, bold, and costly idea. Hesitant Europeans resist. The president's advisors and supporters murmured doubts about the toughness of old Europe. No, it's not Iraq this time. This time, it's the Obama administration's call on European countries to borrow and spend on the same astounding scale as the United States. The United States and Europe will confront these issues face to face at this week's G20 summit. Barack Obama plans to double the U.S. debt load over his time as president, reaching levels last seen at the end of World War II. European governments are less impressed by this brainwave. For 20 years, Europe has attempted to combat unemployment with very high levels of public spending. What they have got out of the experiment is crushing taxation, ominous debts, and not much of a bite out of the unemployment problem. It baffles leaders in France and Germany that the United States would volunteer to inflict these policy errors on itself at just the moment when France and Germany are struggling to undo similar errors of their own. In a crisis, countries must inevitably spend more, tax less, and accept higher deficits. That's one reason why it's so important to keep a good balance sheet in normal economic times, to leave scope to react to crisis. What the Obama administration is proposing for the United States is not a temporary stimulus, but permanently higher spending, taxing, and borrowing. Those who have tasted this medicine understand best how dangerous it is. At the G20, perhaps President Obama should lecture less and listen more.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We would love to hear your thoughts. They come to us best online. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. White House countdown clock for General Motors stands at 58 days today. That's until the Obama administration's financial largesse runs out. Today was also sales reporting day, and the news is that March was less unkind to Detroit than February was. Still grim, though. GM sales tumbled 45% from a year ago. Ford was down 41%. A White House spokesman says the administration remains optimistic that General Motors can restructure without resorting to bankruptcy. One key to that happening is going to be the willingness of GM's workers to make more concessions. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now on the tough choices facing the United Auto Workers.
To survive, GM will have to squeeze more wage and benefit cuts from union employees. And when push comes to shove, UAW leaders will have to decide whether to cut a deal with the company in the next 2 months or cast their fate to a bankruptcy judge this summer.
They are the creditors with the least credit.
Wayne State University economics professor Michael Belzer says bankruptcy procedures are designed to save property, not jobs and wages. He thinks union leaders should avoid the judge, who's almost guaranteed to throw away their contract.
They're better off trying to negotiate something with people they know. Anytime you go into court, you lose control, and General Motors itself has been very concerned about doing that.
A labor-friendly White House with a big say in GM's future could be a valuable ally in protecting union retiree benefits. Don Stillman, a former UAW executive and now labor rights advocate, says the Obama administration must remember how important voters in the industrial Midwest will be for re-election.
You obviously don't want to see a situation where you have 70 or 80-year-old people who've, you know, suffered greatly from the loss of their health care, and that's a dilemma for the administration in these negotiations.
One that could make it difficult for GM to extract big money-saving concessions from union pension and health care funds without going into bankruptcy. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
This is a big day in the U.S. labor market, not in absolute terms, but certainly in political circles. Today is the day the government starts accepting applications for H-1B visas. There are just 85,000 of them to go around to what are called highly skilled foreign workers. The technology industry says it expects demand to widely outstrip supply, even in the face of a weak economy and rising unemployment. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
Companies that hire highly educated foreign-born workers argue that the H-1B visa program is one of the best ways to get this country's economy moving.
American universities are educating the best minds, and it's critical that those minds stay in the United States.
Dean Garfield heads the Information Technology Industry Council. He says new industries like health IT need innovators. Robert Hoffman at Oracle says foreign-born students dominate U.S. high-tech graduate programs.
Roughly 70% of PhD graduates in electrical engineering are foreign-born.
But in the past few months, companies that depend on H-1B visas have become lightning rods.
You know, some of these companies are nothing but pimps.
Republican Senator Charles Grassley says if companies can't find Americans to do a job, it makes sense to hire from abroad. But he's convinced some firms abuse H-1B visas to lay off American workers and hire cheap foreign replacements. And Grassley just co-sponsored a bill to put new restrictions on H-1B visas for bailed-out banks.
Don't tell me when the banks are laying off tens of thousands of people that other banks that want to hire somebody, that they can't find qualified people out of the people that have been laid off.
Grassley's writing another bill aimed at preventing fraud. But some in the tech business worry it could make the process of applying for these visas unworkable. That, they say, will push some talented U.S. graduates overseas. People like Mexican Milton Esteva, he just earned a doctorate in mechanical engineering from Rice University on
trying to find a numerical model to predict the mechanical and thermal properties of nanocomposites.
His research might make accidents at oil rigs less common. That could save his employer, BP America, some money.
But the most important thing is safety.
But if Esteva doesn't get a visa this year, he's not too worried. His American education means jobs are waiting all over the globe. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Wall Street seems to think we can manufacture our way out of this recession. The Dow Industrials rose 152 points today, 2%, finished at 7,761, the blue chips did. The Nasdaq climbed 23 points, 1.5%, closed at 1,551. The S&P 500 was up 13 points, 1.75%, ended the day at 810. Those gains were partly based on a U.S. manufacturing report, which shows promising signs of recovery. U.S. Steel rose 7%. Caterpillar scooped up a 3.75% gain today. The National Association of Realtors says pending home sales are unexpectedly higher. The 2.1% increase in February was good news for home builders. D.R. Horton was up nearly 4.5% today. Centex built a 3% gain. Bonds rose after the Fed announced plans to buy more government debt over the next few weeks. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace Whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for February. The House Agriculture Committee holds a hearing to review federal food safety systems. And ER fans will probably opt to stay home to tune in for the series finale airing tomorrow night. The television drama premiered in 1994. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've been looking at higher education this week, how the recession is influencing the decisions a lot of prospective students are making about where to go to school, and how those decisions are in turn influencing a lot of colleges. Not the ones with the big endowments. Yes, they are hurting with the stock market crash along with the rest of us. But most private schools don't have those endowments to fall back on. They depend on tuition to pay the bills and on students who are able to pay that tuition. Emily Hanford of American Radio Works reports.
Albright is a private liberal arts college in Reading, Pennsylvania. Big trees, brick buildings, about 1,600 students. Kyle Bredbenner is a senior. He grew up nearby, came to camp here as a kid.
And so when I first thought college, this was the first thing that came to mind. I was like, oh, Albright, of course.
Bredbenner's walking to his marketing class.
The topic today, of course, is product strategy. And
this class has 25 students. Most are even smaller. That's one reason the education is so expensive. The sticker price is about $40,000, but almost no one pays all that. Like most private colleges, Albright gives out a lot of financial aid. It has to get students like Bredbenner to come. More than half of his tuition and fees have been covered, but he's still graduating with a hefty debt.
Probably close to, I think it's close to $50,000 in debt now.
Officials at Albright would like to do more to help students like Bredbenner. Several wealthier, more elite colleges have dramatically increased financial aid, so students have little or no debt. But Albright can't compete. There's no big endowment to help foot the bill. 85% of Albright's operating budget comes directly from money students pay.
If we're not filling the classrooms and filling the beds, we're not then able to do all of the other aspects that we want to do, including fund your financial aid.
Greg Eichhorn is Vice President of Enrollment Management. He says Albright's in a tight spot. About a quarter of students come from low-income families. To give them enough aid, Albright must attract families that can pay. But now those families are asking for help, too.
It's kind of daunting. You know, historically, you thought those families were solid and that you could count on them to pay a little bit more and fund families that were needy. You can't anymore.
Eichhorn says a few things are happening at once. Tuition has increased so much that even high-income families have to stretch. And now they're watching investments tank and home values plummet. Plus, high-income families are beginning to feel entitled to aid. It's okay to ask for help. And they're not just asking. They're calling him up to wheel and deal.
XYZ offered me this merit scholarship or this amount of financial assistance. How come you're not?
Eichhorn says Albright is trying to meet demand by offering more financial aid based on merit rather than need. This allows them to give upper-income families a bigger discount. But Albright doesn't want to lose lower-income students, so they're increasing financial aid overall by more than $1 million. They're freezing salaries to do it.
We run very close to the mast all the time.
Lex McMillan is the president of Albright.
Our margins are very close. Our business model, if you will, is financially very challenging.
They worry the sticker price could scare families away. So tuition next year will not go up as much as it has recently. And officials are planning for a smaller school, maybe 60 fewer students, a loss of about $1.3 million in revenue. McMillan says it's sobering, but he's optimistic about the long run. He points out that unemployment among college graduates remains low, even in this harsh economy. And more, people want to go to college.
And they don't regard it as a luxury. They regard it as a necessity to achieve their piece of the American dream.
McMillan says students ask him why Albright costs so much. He tells them he could make it cheaper by doubling class sizes or cutting back on student services like tutoring and career counseling. Senior Kyle Bredbenner says, don't do that. He thinks his Albright education has been worth it, though he's anxious about graduating in this economy. No one's getting job offers. He says his friends have started thinking about Plan B.
You know what? The job market sucks right now. Maybe I'll just go back to school.
In Reading, Pennsylvania, I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
Anybody who's ever tried to figure out student loans and financial aid packages knows that the high finance of higher education can be opaque. We called Don Heller at the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State to talk about that, whether the recession might make the system more forthcoming, and what exactly those tuition checks pay for anyway.
Part of it certainly is paying for my salary as a professor at a university. It's paying for the buildings. It's paying for the president. On some universities, you may even be subsidizing the athletic department and the football coach a little bit.
Are parents, and I guess to some extent kids, really thinking about the nicer dorms and the great athletic facilities, or do they just want the diploma and the education and then to get out there in the working world?
The whole issue about the amenities in higher education, everybody loves to talk about the climbing walls and things like that and the dorms that are so much nicer than when the parents went to college. All of those things are receiving a huge amount of scrutiny. And I don't think there's any question that there's a movement on to look at whether we really need to have the sort of gold-plated or even silver-plated type of amenities that many colleges provide. I know in my state, in Pennsylvania and other states, there's been a movement at trying to start up a sort of no-frills, low-cost public university that would provide a very basic education, give people what they need so that they can attain a bachelor's degree without all the frills and hopefully at a much lower cost.
With the economy being the way it is, though, and with people paying more attention to where their money is going, is that going to create a drive for more transparency among institutions of higher education?
Well, I think in the last few years, there's been a movement towards more transparency. Certainly, the economic situation has probably speeded this up a little bit. But with all of the rises in tuition prices we've seen in the last couple of decades, there has been movement in the last few years to try to make the whole pricing of tuition and the college education in general more transparent for students and parents. So that's something that's being worked on. And as I said, I believe it's being pushed forward even more so by the economic situation and the concerns that students and parents have about getting their money's worth out of their tuition.
Let me ask you the price elasticity question. Given that we are in a recession, many, many things out there are getting cheaper. Consumers simply aren't willing to pay what's being asked. Is there, do you think, a chance that tuitions might be coming down on average?
I would say there's a very, very slim chance that tuitions will actually come down. What we are seeing are announcements from universities, both public and private, that what they're trying to do is moderate their tuition increases for the fall. The last two decades, we've had increases at both public and private universities of about twice the rate of inflation. And I think what you're going to see in the fall when the numbers come out that show the averages across the whole nation, you're going to see a much more moderate rate of increase than in past years.
Don Heller, he's the director of the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Pennsylvania State University. Professor Heller, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
There was a tiny glimmer of hope for the housing industry this morning. According to the Commerce Department, construction spending didn't fall as much last month as experts had been guessing. But it is still plenty hard to sell the houses that are being built right now. That's especially true in places like Nevada and California, where suburbs that were overbuilt and overpriced look like ghost towns now. Developers are more desperate than ever to clear those foreclosed or unsold homes off their books. So they're stealing a page from the Realtor's Playbook. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us some builders are trying to stage the next real estate turnaround.
It's a Wednesday morning, and I'm heading toward a cul-de-sac of luxury homes in a gated community called Fox Run Estates, about 90 miles north of Los Angeles. Each home has a three-car garage on a landscaped half acre.
Here, wait a second. I'll come out.
Mark Zuckerman thought he got a good deal when he bought this home recently for just $480,000. Turns out, though, it wasn't all good.
It is a nice neighborhood, but there's no kids playing in the street. You don't hear lawnmowers going. I mean, there's nobody here.
But Zuckerman says there were people barbecuing next door when he came to the open house, and he even met them when he came back for a weekend tour. His family moved in last Tuesday, and the neighbors' houses were empty.
So who were those people?
Who those people were actors hired to play neighbors in an increasingly cutthroat real estate market where staging a home now means much more than just putting out fancy deck furniture and baking cookies. These days, savvy realtors sometimes stage whole neighborhoods, mowing lawns on abandoned properties, hiring dog walkers to stroll the streets, and when the financial stakes are high enough, employing professional actors to give the place a truly lived-in feel. I get to see this played out the following weekend.
Welcome! Come in! Come in!
There's a steady stream of potential homebuyers coming through, as well as others who may or may not be their future neighbors.
Can I get you some cookies or maybe some coffee?
The actors staging this house have worked in commercials and repertory theater. They ask that their names not be used.
Well, I'm a professional actor. I play a lawyer, and she's also a mom. She's just not going to have enough time to bake your brownies when you move in.
When I saw the call for a living theater piece, I thought it'd be brilliant. Of course, I play the father, who's a little more laid back and fun to be with. Of course, I can talk to you about my power tools in an American accent.
Nobody wants to hear about the power tools, Roger. That's not working.
I'll talk about my power mower, then.
As I said, we're method actors.
Their role isn't limited to chatting over the backyard fence. They might invite their future neighbors to a Little League game. Teams are borrowed from another town, or attend a staged church service and sing hymns. Consumer advocates charge this as false advertising, and they say it may even be illegal to fill empty homes with temporary neighbors, then move them out once a sale closes. But developer Randy De Niro says nothing they're doing goes over the line.
Look around. You don't see anybody impersonating a cop, do you? Because why? Because that would be illegal. It's an image of a nice neighborhood, even if it's not nice right now.
After all, De Niro says, the run-up in home prices was partly built on smoke and mirrors, and the recovery might have to be as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've pulled some of our best April 1st pieces from the archives. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today, I was always more of a General Hospital guy myself, but the passing of any soap opera that's been on for more than 15,000 episodes deserves a mention. CBS announced today it's pulling the plug on Guiding Light. It actually got started as a radio show 72 years ago. Procter & Gamble Productions, yes, that Procter & Gamble of Ivory and Tide, said today the last episode is going to air on September the 18th. And there is good news for the fashion conscious among you. There's a deal to get Project Runway back on the air. NBC Universal, Lifetime, and Harvey Weinstein announced today that the show where clothing designers compete is going to air on Lifetime this fall. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this April Fool's Day. Today, the Dow rose 152 points, 2%, finished at 7,761. The NASDAQ added 23 points, 1.5%, closed at 1551. The S&P 500 gained 13 points, 1.2%, ended the day at 810. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, how recession could mean lights out for the paparazzi.
You'd be surprised sometimes, like, hey, fine, this is a nice picture, you're happy at the end of the day, but next morning you know that you didn't sell. So it's unpredictable to say really what they want right now.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.